Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm still on location up in DeKalb, Illinois, at Northern Illinois University. And today we've got a special guest who's going to talk about primate evolution, which I presume must mean also our own evolution to a certain extent. His name is Professor Dan Gibo, and he's in the Department of Anthropology. And so, Dan, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you very much, Keith.
Before we get into the whole concept of what you do, I want to learn a little bit about you. How did Dan become an anthropologist? What were those moments when you were a young kid or a middle-aged kid, whatever it is, that you began to say, hey, this is a career I could go for?
Well, it took a while, as you might imagine. I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, so I'm a Western boy compared to the Midwest here, and we moved around a lot. I actually went to three different high schools, but when I was a sophomore in high school in a school in California, I took a biology class, and I just fell in love with this idea about animals being adapted and the idea of evolution that you could change over time. And I have to say, from that one time on, when I was about 15, maybe 16, I basically moved in the direction to kind of study evolution, and particularly when I was a senior in a different high school in a different state, we kind of had an independent study year as a second-year biology student, and I basically studied human evolution. It was the time of Louis Leakey, and, you know, there's lots of Time
absolutely.
Magazine articles, and as you might imagine, it was fun for me. And then I somehow, and I'm not sure how I ever got this in my mind, but I realized if I majored in anthropology as a college student, I wouldn't get enough biology background. So I actually majored in zoology and then took all my kind of elective classes in anthropology, or what we call physical anthropology, and eventually went on to graduate school and so on.
Where did you go to school?
Oregon State University for that. I have a master's degree from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and my PhD is from Duke. Coach K and I actually started at Duke at the same year, so we actually, when Duke wasn't so good.
Right. Been a remarkable story, but so is yours. So then, obviously, you got a PhD then in this area, and how did you decide, you know, what aspect of human evolution or primate evolution, how do you begin to say, I'm going to make my original contribution to this?
Well, it's difficult, as you might imagine, particularly for graduate students. This is something you struggle with. You want to make a contribution. Everybody seems so smart. All the work has already been done, and you have to figure out your own little niche. I was always interested in locomotion, or how animals move. So where most paleontologists study teeth, I wasn't really interested in teeth. And so I was always interested in arm bones and leg bones and foot bones, which is probably my real area of expertise and so on. And so I studied locomotion, and then you have to kind of pick a problem. So I kind of thought of the origin of anthropoids, which is the origin of higher primates, monkeys, apes, and humans. So we have these primitive primates like lemurs or galagos, and then eventually they're going to become more advanced like anthropoids, eventually, of course, be apes, and eventually humans. So that transition was important, and my advisor at the time collected fossils at a place called the Fayum in Egypt. And at the time, the earliest fossil anthropoids were from the Fayum in Egypt. And we have the Duke Primate Center at there, and there's lemurs and galagos. So I had all these living primates that I could watch how they moved and how they used their hands and feet. I could look at the fossils, which were at the time cutting edge in terms of that area. And so I put my dissertation together based on that, and I focused on the foot anatomy in particular.
Did you have to know a little bit of physics?
I did a little bit of
this whole
mechanics,
articulation.
But yeah, I'm not a great physicist in terms of that, but I did some of the lever mechanics, some basic biomechanic things. But I was really interested in how, in this case, foot anatomy differed between lemurs and galagos and tarsiers, all these different types of primates, and they're actually quite different, as it turns out. And then anthropoids have a very distinct adaptive level, too, that's different. So you have to think about, well, how are you going to evolve a foot of a monkey, to put it simply? And you've got lots of options, you know, in the fossil record as well as living primates, but which one works best? And, of course, you know, there were various debates. And it's not just foot anatomy. Of course, everybody's thinking about the whole big picture of how you just basically get things to be an anthropoid.
But you have to start somewhere.
Somewhere.
And the foot's relatively,
right.
You know, simple.
Well, it's simple in sense, but it has a lot of bones, right? I mean,
right.
So actually it's fairly, you know, and it was an area, unlike the teeth or heads, that hasn't been as well studied. So that was a little more open niche for me. I spent a lot of time doing dissections. I did a lot of time watching animals move in all the cages. I mean, literally hundreds of hours of observation. And so I had a really good sense why lorises were different from lemurs, or we call these things indriids or shafakas. There are different types of lemurs on Madagascar. And so I figured out what all they could do. Then I looked at their bones and their joints, and then I looked at their muscles, and I tried to sort out how their feet worked. And then I thought about the evolutionary questions.
That's, I mean, the way you sum it up, it's like, wow, all of this and you're in the graduate school. And but the first thing that strikes me is saying, I'm rather surprised that a lot of this was not known before you started your graduate studies.
Well, certainly I built on others. I mean,
yeah,
certainly some things were certainly known. But you're right. I mean, a lot of it really wasn't thought of or as thorough or as well developed across all the different groups. The other thing I guess I should mention is one of the other positive things about studying foot bones is they fossilize. So we actually, as you also find teeth in the fossil record, it turns out that foot bones, particularly the ankle and heel bone, are more common. So when you look at various localities and different time periods around the world, you actually usually have some evidence to look at.
And that's because they're smaller,
they're
more
small and hard, exactly right.
Right.
And
okay.
If you think about it, most of the long bones are broken, right? So you don't get a really nice complete arm bone or a humerus upper arm bone. What you get is usually the elbow or maybe the shoulder if you're lucky, but the middle parts are usually broken away and not preserved. So some elements are just easier to study, and that's also more common, so you can make a better story about what's going on.
So if you think about this, or I'm thinking about it, is there a depository of feet somewhere around the
there
world?
There are. I mean, those fossils are all in the regular, you know, big, usually natural history museums around the world, including
right.
in the U.S., so Chicago Field Museum here, or
so once
Museum
you've
of
picked
Natural
on
History.
Feet.
You could go
the world,
all around.
In museums.
I bounced around all the natural museums in Europe with, you know, from train to train with little chocolate bars in my pocket because I was a poor graduate student, right? So, and I went from basement to basement of these places as
right.
I looked at all these kind of unusual bones. And the one advantage I had, maybe didn't appreciate it early on, but since most people were experts on teeth, they actually couldn't tell primate bones from the other small mammals. So rodents or insectivores or even little carnivores were often mixed up. So I would go to what we call the miscellaneous bone boxes, and I would actually pull out the primates. And as a consequence, I'm the first one, of course, to identify primate bones of this species from wherever it is around
That's great.
The world. So kind of made a living without collecting fossils. You can kind of bounce from museum to museum.
So all museums have a miscellaneous bone box.
They do, usually, for all the fossil localities. That's exactly
Good.
Right.
Okay, so you got your PhD from Duke, and then you say, well, now I'm going to carry on with this. This is too much fun. How can you not want to do a career? So how did you then choose? Did you continue with the foot race, so to speak, or did you choose another area?
I've certainly continued. There was, once you do your PhD, you have to then write those articles for journals, so you're kind of slicing and dicing most of that big project. I've continued to work on foot bones. I've worked on arms and legs, and I'm working on little fingers and toes these days, and so all the other parts of bodies. I just shifted to different time periods. So if you want to study the origin of apes, for example, you need to go to Africa in the early Miocene about 20 million years ago. And there are various fossils. You can find some yourself. I found some in Uganda, for example, a thing called Morodopithecus, but you can also find them in other museums. If you want to do human evolution, you'd go back to at least the beginnings of it. You'd be somewhere 5 or 6, and you'd look at East or South Africa and find the right sediments and go
right.
out and see what you could find. And the same thing occurs. So we ended up moving to my colleagues and I. It turns out the origin of anthropoids is in Asia, and it's about 10 million years older than the material that was coming out of Egypt that I did with my dissertation. So we went to Asia, and we found these things called eosimiids.
Whereabouts?
It's in central China and even on the coastal areas of China, so some different places. But they're very tiny. So as you think of monkeys, they're kind of cat-sized. They eat fruit. We call them quadrupedal, that, you know, they're arboreal, they move with all four limbs. Well, it turns out their ancestors would fit in the palm of your hand. They're tiny, tiny animals like mouse lemurs are. If they're too tiny, you eat maybe some fruit, but you eat insects, so you might imagine their teeth and their digestive systems are very different. They're much more active leapers, so they have long legs, and all these things are all completely different. So their ancestry is completely different, and it looks like they come from Asia, and looks like the origin of primates also is Asian. So I guess what I'm trying to get you to think about is you pick different evolutionary problems, but the solutions are in different continents. So you can find fossil primates in North America, and they're 50 million years old. They're very interesting, but they're probably not at the very beginning, so when these major lineages separated out.
So all this study, right, you've gone around the world collecting feet and now other limbs, et cetera. What have you learned in a nutshell about the evolutionary process? Because do you do DNA analysis, for example? I mean, because that's what most people will think today. Well, if you're going to do evolution, you're going to do something along the line of DNA analysis.
I do not do DNA. There's been many molecular studies using DNA or even proteins, and they're good for the living primates. But, of course, they don't tell you anything about the fossil record or the historical record of all these groups. So DNA has not been able to get out of these things that are, if you really think about fossils, they're rocks, right? They've been mineralized, so they look like bones. But in fact, if you hold a fossil in your hand and that same bone in the other, the fossil is much heavier. So it is much more like a rock.
So it's impossible to get DNA fragments.
It's been impossible. Now, we've gotten some out of Neanderthals lately, okay? And so we're starting to move a little bit in that direction, at least, let's say, 50 to 100,000 years old, not anything that's millions of years old. But perhaps someday we can find some organic material, and that would certainly be helpful.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dan Gibo from the Department of Anthropology at Northern Illinois University, and we're talking about feet that are 50 million years old, 30 million years old, and we're trying to learn something about the evolution of primates. We'll take a small break, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Not that I need an excuse to eat chocolate, but I've got one anyway. A new study shows flavanols in cocoa can reverse age-related memory decline, and I need that.
Don't you ever.
You're in the same boat, Dave.
Yeah. So bring on the flavanols, which are a potent antioxidant found in a variety of plants. They help our cells deal with free radicals, which come from normal cellular processes, but also environmental contaminants such as cigarette smoke.
Unless your body gets rid of free radicals, they can damage proteins, lipids, and even your genetic information. In the new study, a cocoa drink designed to retain its flavanols was compared with another that contained very little.
37 adults aged 50 to 69 were randomly selected. One group consumed 900 milligrams a day of flavanols compared to the control group, which drank just 10 milligrams for 3 months.
Both groups took brain imaging and memory tests before and after the study, as well as measurements of blood flow to the dentate gyrus responsible for pattern recognition. Those who consumed high levels of cocoa flavanols had better function in the dentate gyrus and had improved memory.
So someone with the memory of a 60-year-old before the study scored the memory of a 30 to 40-year-old after the study. That's a huge reversal.
If you're rushing to the pantry for a chocolate bar, make that 23, because that's how many you'd have to eat in a day to equal the amount of flavanols the study subjects took.
Since flavanols are found in tea, red wine, and berries as well, a potent wonder drink may not be that far in our future.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Dan Gibo from the Department of Anthropology, Northern Illinois University, and we're talking about primate evolution. So you've got all this collection. You now can look at a foot and understand intuitively almost, I think, how did it function? How did it differ from something that's 3 million years later or earlier? What have we learned that has allowed us to understand ourselves in our terms of our own evolution?
Well, we've learned, as you might expect, quite a lot, although there's still more to go. So when I think about evolutionary problems, there's usually two themes. You think about adaptation, Okay, so how do things function? How do they work? Whether they're arms and legs, grasping, for example, with foot bones and so on. Or you think about phylogeny, which is the ancestor-descendant relationships of these things. So one of the things that we've been trying to deal when people think about evolution, they really think it's about ancestry, and they think of evolutionary trees and so on and the relationships of all these taxa. And we've moved a lot. I mean, for example, the eosimians that I mentioned earlier, they weren't known until the mid-1990s. Okay, so this was it was a very controversial time. A lot of people didn't think these were primates even in the beginning when they found they have some funny cusp on their lower molar teeth and other things.
Just remind us again the definition of a primate.
Okay, well, a primate is a group of mammals, okay, a placental mammals, and they have lots of characteristics. One of them is they have grasping hands and feet. They have nails instead of claws. Okay, so they have big thumbs and big toes that can swing across like our hands do. We're not so good with our big toes anymore, but in terms of our hands. They brought their eyes forward, so your right eye actually has a visual field that overlaps with your left eye. Okay, even with primates with fairly longer nose, this has occurred. And what this allows us to do with some rewiring of our brain is it gives us stereoscopic, a 3D vision. And you might imagine that's pretty helpful when you're 100 feet up in a tree bouncing around between branches.
It's pretty useful on a golf course, too.
Right. So we have these big changes of what primates have in terms of how they were more visually oriented than using our noses, or the term is olfaction for smelling. We're going to change our teeth. We're going to be probably more insect-eating oriented earlier, but we're going to eat fruits and leaves later on. And so as you might imagine, the cusp of your teeth change. You might think about canine sizes, for example, and so on. And you're going to begin to change your body for life in trees. So our elbow joints are very mobile compared to other mammals, particularly terrestrial mammals, for example, and all the way on down. So there is a host of anatomical characters. We can even do some soft tissue characters or some reproductive issues and so on that you can find. But really the shift from smelling to vision was a key factor, and grasping up in the trees.
Okay. So now we're going back to the what we have discovered about the evolutionary mode, and how does that relate to ourselves and future evolution? Because, you know, one studies the past, and in theory one says you learn from history. You know, history will repeat itself, but if we're clever, we can avoid some of the pitfalls. What can you say about your predictions for the way that primates, mammals, ourselves are going to evolve?
Well, it's always a chancy game to go out on this limb.
Oh, absolutely, but this is science.
You
studio.
Know that
you're the expert.
You know that the closest living relatives to humans are the African apes, and particularly the chimpanzees are our closest. And it might seem surprising, but the molecular work that you talked about earlier, the DNA work, actually has shown that chimpanzees are more closely related to us than they are to gorillas. And of course, adaptively, as well as their bones, as you might imagine, they look very similar to gorillas because they live in central part of Africa. They're what we call knuckle walkers. So they fold their fingers and walk on their knuckles, right?
Chimpanzees?
Chimpanzees do that. And it's not that they can't climb trees, but they're actually very terrestrial, and so are gorillas. We call them terrestrial quadrupeds. So they're actually on the ground most of the time. And in fact, the people who do the quantitative locomotor studies, they're like 98% knuckle walkers. I mean, they're very specialized. Most primates, you know, they jump a little bit, they climb a little bit, they move quadrupedally a little bit, and you know, we kind of mix this stuff up. Some primates swing by their arms, like gibbons and so on. This is one of the reasons I study locomotion, because you have a really diverse group among primates compared to other mammals. So we have this ancestral African ape ancestor, if you will, and we share a last common ancestor with chimps. So for us, we are going to break off and we're going to become terrestrial bipeds, so we're going to really change our legs and our hips and so on, our lower back. But the rest of our upper body, actually our chest, our arms, our shoulder joints and so on, is just like the living ape. So you could use a dissector and do a chimp arm or a human arm, and you could use Gray's Anatomy for humans, and you wouldn't be confused about where the muscles are. So they're very similar. In terms of future studies for human evolution and so on, as you can see that we spend a lot of time sitting in chairs, right, and not eating the best food. And so our bones are getting thinner, right? So osteoporosis is a big problem usually in the elderly and so on. It's because we have bad habits, okay, and we're not doing the same types of physical activity even in our pioneer days, let alone back to when we were in forests and so on. So you can imagine that things like that are kind of going out. So our little toes and our feet are shrinking, right? We have hardly any bones in those little digits. you could potentially lose your fifth little pinky toe in the future.
And give me a time frame here. If you look at the first human, let's say 300 years ago, from 300 to now, have those little toes got much smaller?
No, in that time frame, nothing's happened. Humans only go back, anatomically modern humans go back between 150, which is where the fossil record is. It's probably about 200,000 years ago.
Right.
So we've only had, our species is only around a couple hundred thousand years, so nothing like millions of years of the other things we could talk about. But you're right. The one thing I can demonstrate or could talk about is one of the things that you will notice from earlier time periods with humans to now is we're much bigger. And if you go to any of the houses in the United States, like George Washington or Jefferson's or Revolutionary period a couple hundred years ago, the doorknobs, like 6 inches lower, right? And so we're all tall. And you can see how somebody like from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln, is quite interesting because he's huge, especially for his time period, being, 6'4" or something like that. So in terms of that, our nutrition and health benefits have essentially moved us in some areas. We're living longer and those types of issues. But, of course, we have some side effects of that, like cancer and other things from terms of long living. Early fossil humans never had problems with cancers because they were dead before they were 25. They never have any of these types of senescence or other issues. And so I guess if you think about humanity, we're kind of moving in directions where we don't need very strong physical bodies. We may not need our ear flaps for sound because things – we're probably always going to need our fingers because we're always toying around with buttons and doing this or that. It's hard to think of us having these super huge brains that you see in sci-fi stories because, you have obstetric problems with the pelvis, right? Our brains are about as big as they can be and still be born at least normally. And now if you want to have C-sections or do something else, gross and test tubes, I guess you can play the genetic engineering game and decide what you want, and you can probably manipulate everything. But we, as we all know, is we carry a host of bad genes because of these things. We all, most of us, myself included, wear contacts. We have bad vision, right? So, there's all then we always talk about all the positive things or somehow you're advancing. We always have this idea that we're going to be superior. But as we well know, if we blow up the planet or blow up ourselves, the cockroaches will survive, but humans may not.
Oh, that's a lesson I learned a long time ago. I did a postdoc at the University of Georgia, and I used to play golf with a professor in the biological sciences, and all he studied was cockroaches and the impact of irradiation, because in those days there was still this sort of thought that there could be a nuclear conflict. Right, and so he said, these little buggers, he said, they resist almost everything.
They have great
They will be here
enzymes.
Forever. All right. And in fact, I don't know how people get rid of cockroaches. I never saw a cockroach before I came to America, and cockroach was associated with dirty living or something. And only when I came here did I realize that's got nothing to do with it. And anyway, that's another story. So what's your current real exciting discovery or finding or right today?
I guess I'd say I'd go back 1 year, okay? And 1 year ago, we named a skeleton called Archicebus, and it is 55 million years old. It fits in the palm of your hand, and it's right at the very beginnings of primate evolution. So, it really is in the beginning.
This is the one you found in China?
It was found in China. This is a different fossil from the others, but yes, and it's much earlier than the Eosimids by about 10 million years. But anyway, and it's a partial skeleton. So, one thing to find a jaw or a few teeth of this thing, but to have pretty much the whole body that you can sit in your hand. And so we took it and we had it fancily x-rayed. So here's some technology that we've added, and you could develop these 3D images. And one of the nice things about this x-ray work, which was done in Grenoble, France, by the way, is you can actually see the impressions in the rock. So sometimes the fossils weren't there or a piece of the tooth, but you could actually see that image of what that tooth looked like from the impression in the rock. So these x-rays are very finely going. They go for hours and hours and hours, but you scan your fossil and then you can kind of put this stuff together with computers. So we've learned a lot about it, and it's a very primitive thing. It had some pieces of anatomy that we were surprised to see it there. It
has has
long metatarsals, which are the bones and the kind of you think of the palm of your hand, but this is in the foot. It has foot bones like monkeys, but the rest of the body looked like these other more primitive primates. So it had this weird combination of very primitive teeth, a very primitive-looking head, and things like that, arms and so on that we could go through. Then we got to the foot, didn't look like any fossil we'd ever found ever. Okay, so although the top two-thirds of it, I could say we call this group called Omomyid. It would be like an Omomyid, a fossil Eocene primate. And I don't think anybody would have blinked. It would have probably been a new species, but nothing. But no one ever saw a foot attached to this thing. So, of course, with my expertise, essentially, this was a perfect fossil. This foot is actually a third the length of its whole leg, which is already incredibly long. So I'm just telling you, it's really odd. It has long toes. It's got these long metatarsals.
And there's nothing else in the record that you've seen before.
Nothing like
comes
this.
Close.
Nothing that looks like this at that time, for sure. It does have some anatomical similarities. Long metatarsals are found in anthropoids. So we thought for a long time this might be even a primitive monkey. And that was one of the big debates among my colleagues, was it a primitive, we'll just call it a primitive primate or a primitive anthropoid, essentially a monkey. And there's only a few characters or anatomical differences that made that distinction. We end up deciding it was on the more primitive primate side, but it tells us a lot about anthropoid evolution, because if you just flipped a couple things, you'd pretty much have that ancestor.
So there's still surprises out there.
There are still surprises
based upon discovery of relics. I mean,
and something like Archicebus is probably found once in maybe 100 years. I mean, this is a very rare fossil to be that complete, let alone at that age.
And have others been found subsequently, or is this the only sole example?
This is the sole example. There is no other material besides this one.
Talk to that for a moment, because the listeners, you know, they're not anthropologists and all the rest of it, and you find this beautiful specimen, but it's unique. It's the only one. What does that tell you about anything?
Well, I guess, you know, most of us are comparative anatomists, so we look at the bones and we kind of make up the story that seems to make sense in terms of that. But you're right in the sense that unique fossils, or the rare fossils even better, are usually the most important ones. So it's great to have sample sizes, okay? So if you go to Wyoming in the United States in a place called the Bighorn Basin, you can find a fossil primate by the name of Canius. And it's the third most common mammal, okay? The very first fossil primate I ever found was Canius, okay, and so on. And anybody, whether you have experience or non-experience, I bet you I can take you out in a day and you can probably find a jaw of Canius. And there's probably 30,000 jaws of this thing. So you can do more interesting work, like different localities, and you can watch the little cusps change through very fine little limits of time. You can do very fine work. But finding another jaw Canius doesn't change the big picture of right. primate evolution, where something like Archicebus actually did. So those are the differences, and there are plenty of little fossils known around the world.
How deep was this fossil when you found it?
It was found in a rock, piece of rock that was split, and we opened the halves up, and there it was. So it was found.
And the rock was split by yourselves, or
it was found actually not by us, by somebody before us, and it's part of a rock sequence that's at a bottom of Fossil Lake, and so these things were falling in. Mostly, you find fossil fish. In the United States, we have this place called the Green River in Wyoming, and you find all these fossil fish, and occasionally you find a mammal or a bird, and this is the exact same place in China. So we just happened to find this, recognize what it was, and then it took several years of study, as you might imagine, from the experts to come out with the final
impressive
paper at Nature.
Impressive. We could talk and talk and talk. So Dan Gibo, Department of Anthropology, Northern Illinois University, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. It's been fascinating. And I would like also to thank Carl Nelson from WNIJ DeKalb, Illinois, for being the engineer on this program. And, of course, I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for editing it and making it so that it's as wonderful to listen to as it has been. Thank you very much.
Thank you as well, Keith.
And thank the listeners out there. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.